Hi, I'm Dick Edwards, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be invited to this meeting tonight. I'm glad to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I take my involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous very seriously because it saved my life. And I heard at my very first meeting that if you ask to do things for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you cannot say no. That there will be a series of requests asked of you from time to time. And when you ask to do anything for the program, you cannot say no. So I take my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous very seriously, and when I'm asked to do something, although it makes me uncomfortable, I do it. It seems that since I've been doing the things that make me uncomfortable, I've been more comfortable than I've ever been in my life. So I think I can continue to do these things. I've been around long enough that I'm not sure I know what an alcoholic really is, but I know what an alcoholic isn't. And to give you an illustration of that, a few weeks ago I was asked to participate in a meeting down in Hemet. And I went early. I usually go to meetings early. I like to be on time. I don't like people waiting on me, and I don't like to wait on people. So I'm generally obsessive about time, as I am many other things. But I got to the meeting early, so I had time to have dinner by myself and watch the people, and I like to do that. If any of you are from Hemet, Hemet is a culinary wasteland. But they have a restaurant down there, and I went to it, and I noticed some people ordering wine with dinner, and I had an opportunity to watch the wine ritual, and I'd never really paid any attention to that before. But this table of four, one of the old guys was ordering wine, and he ordered Lancer's wine for dinner. And I'm here to tell you that Lancer's is not good wine. I don't care what anybody says. The only thing it's got going for it, it comes in a clay jar, and that's about the end of the review. And in Hemet, the wine ritual goes sort of like the waitress comes with an old plastic bucket, and she puts it by the table. And they have a Mickey Mouse little tripod, and they balance the bucket on it. And then she did her thing with the linen towel, and somebody came by and poured shaved ice in the plastic bucket, and then she showed it to the old bird, and he nodded. And then they took the corkscrew and pulled the cork out. The squeaking sound of the cork came out, and I was really getting entertained by this. And then she poured a little bit in his glass for him, and he smelled the bouquet of the Lancers. And then he took a little and wiggled his ears a couple of times and nodded, and that was her signal to pour wine for the table. I said, drink the goddamn wine, you know, Jesus Christ. I knew they weren't alcoholics because alcoholics don't have time for anything with corks in it to start with. If it's not snap off, flip off, pop off, bite off, screw off, you know, inadvertently, I'm sure all of us at one time or another got something with a cork in it. Alcoholics don't own corkscrews. That's all there is to that. But most alcoholics do have access to a paring knife. And we are... jam the paring knife down in it and quarter the cork and push it down inside the bottle. Spitting pieces of cork out and drinking the wine. And that's the way I know how to drink. I don't know about wine rituals and tasting and smelling and all that stuff. But I enjoyed watching that. It indicated to me that there are people around that can have wine with dinner and it's okay for them. But it entertained me. I've also been around long enough that I don't entertain the idea of myself drinking. I don't romance alcohol. I generally don't go to places that serve alcohol if I have a choice. It says somewhere that if you have a good business or social reason to be in a place that serves alcohol, fulfill your business or social obligation and get the hell out of there. And I try to adhere to that principle all the time. I don't entertain the idea of drinking. I don't go to bars and drink Cokes. I don't drink near beer. I think it's dangerous for people like myself to order Virgin Marys and sit around bars trying to do whatever it occurs in bars anymore. After all, people don't go to a whorehouse for a kiss. I Jimmy Swagger does, but... I come from a family of alcoholics. I'm not going to blame my alcoholism on that. It's just a simple fact. Everybody in my family was alcoholic. My grandparents on both sides, my mother and dad, my aunts and uncles, and all my cousins. The only person in my family who's not alcoholic is my sister. And I'm firmly convinced the only reason she's not alcoholic is because she never drank like I did. I'm further convinced that had I never drank like I did, I would have never become alcoholic either. But something happened when I put that magic elixir alcohol into my system. I became like the other members of my family, only worse. My family were all home drinkers. They didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. We all lived in a big house over here in West LA near 3rd and La Cienega. We all lived together, the grandmas and grandpas and moms and dads and uncles and aunts and all of us kids. And it was a good environment. My family were not physically abusive people or verbally abusive people. They had a good work ethic. We all lived together. They all went to work every day. They all came home early every afternoon. They were all dry cleaners by trade. They came home early and gathered in the kitchen and drank out of bags. They got, each one got their own bottle home, and they peeled the neck of the sack back, screwed the cap off, and drank out of bags and shared their day, what had been going on in their life for that day. And it was boring. You know, as a kid, I would wander around hearing all the things that my family had done for a lifetime when you get to hear it on a daily basis. And I didn't see any fun in the kind of drinking they did. My dad disappeared a lot. He left our family when I was about 5 years old, around 1936. And he was the kind of a guy you wouldn't send to the store for a loaf of bread that would come back 3 or 4 weeks later. My dad would be gone for 6, 7, 8, 9 years. And my mother was a slow learner. She remarried 5 more times. Her husbands all shared 2 things in common. They were all alcoholic and all dry cleaners. So we were the biggest... biggest bunch of drunks in West LA, but we had the cleanest clothes of anybody. I had one stepdad that I was quite fond of. He stuck around longer than most. His name was Ray, a real nice little guy. He had a little cane and joint up near 3rd and Fairfax that he ran by himself as a little retail store. He was a periodic. I know that today. I didn't know it then. Ray would come home in that old Pontiac he drove with a case of booze and a carton of candles and go to bed with it, and when he was hospitalized, he'd quit drinking. That's the kind of drinker he was. And like so many of us that don't find a way to go, several years ago, Ray died in the Olivet Sanitarium of alcoholism, tuberculosis, and syphilis. The booze don't get you, the side effects will. If you hang out there long enough, something is going to happen that you don't want. And I know something happened to Ray that was against his wishes. He wasn't the kind of a guy that would get those kinds of things, or those kinds of things would happen to. He went to the CUNY cure a lot. We don't hear much about the CUNY cure, but I knew about it when I was a kid, and it never worked for my stepdad. When I was 17, I joined the Navy. I always wanted to be older than I was. I always wanted to hang around with older people. My uncles had all been in the service in the Second World War, and I wanted what they had. I wanted to be a man. That's what I've searched for all my life, is manhood, and I searched for that in alcohol and many, many other ways. But when I was 17, I knew that if I went into the service, I'd be a man. So I joined the Navy, and instant manhood. As soon as I put on that set of Navy blues, I was a man in my own book. I went to town, got drunk, chased girls, got tattooed, did all the things that Navy men did in 1948, and it was fantastic. I learned how to drink in the service. I hung around with older guys, and they said, Dick, pace yourself, drink only 4 drinks an hour, dance a little bit, eat a little bit, you know, don't just sit there and chug them down, you won't last the night, and... you do what you're told. And after a while, it started working. And I loved booze from the first time out. And I knew that booze was going to be my friend for a long, long time. And it was very, very good to me. It allowed me to be something I was not. And in the service, I applied for cook school, and they made a parachute rigger out of me. That's the way they do things sometimes in the service. But it turned out to be a glamorous job, and I was connected with a thing called a bailout trainer, and would go around to the Naval Air Stations and the Marine Corps Air Stations and teach Navy pilots how to bail out of fighter airplanes in a ground-simulated situation. And it was a glamorous job for an 18, 19, 20-year-old impressionable kid that was already alcoholic. The best part of the job was at the end of the work day, the officers would take us to the officers' club and buy us a couple of mixed drinks. God damn, that was great. You know, I'm dressed in a flight suit, just like an officer. I'm sitting at the bar with the officers, And I think, I don't know if social drinkers do this, but this alcoholic did it. I went out of sales and convinced myself on those occasions that I was an officer. You know, how ridiculous. I don't think social drinkers have to do that. But the Navy was good to me, and I enjoyed it. I drank as much as my money would allow and as much as my buddy's money would allow. And when it came time for me to get out, I got out. I got a little job in East L.A. I met the first girl I was ever interested in my life. I met her in a bar, where else? And the thing that appealed to me about her is she was engaged to be married to a naval officer. And I knew if I could beat that naval officer's time, I would arrive as a man. And as I look back on it, it was comparatively easy. It was a little easier that he was in Korea at the time and I was here, but nevertheless, I got the job done, and when I did, I didn't know what to do, so I went ahead and married her. And that was the start of a 12-year marriage that was destined for failure from the very beginning, because I didn't know the girl, I didn't really like her, and my brother-in-law and sister drove us to Las Vegas to get married at one of those little wedding chapels. We'd been drinking all night, and when I got up there, standing on the porch while the girls were dressing, I told my brother-in-law, I can't marry her. He said, Jesus Christ, Dick, I just put $10 worth of gas in this old car and drove you kids up here. You got to marry her. And I said, well, hell, with rationale like that, let's get on with it. And that's the way alcoholics make lifelong commitments. Mercifully, the wedding of the marriage was over in 12 years. The job that I took when we first got married was a very, very good job. It started out a very low pay in a factory in East L.A., and I worked my way up through the factory and into the office and into the purchasing department and into the sales department, and eventually became sales manager of that company. And the job lasted for many years. The people that owned the company were very good to me. There were two guys out of the Second World War that had put their life savings in this company. They were both alcoholic. All the other salesmen were alcoholic. Everybody that worked in the plant was alcoholic. It was fantastic. I eventually traveled the United States, going to trade shows and conventions, setting up hospitality rooms, working with hotel maitre d's, cocktail waitresses, bartenders, bell captains. It was fantastic. These guys would give you large sums of money and send you out of town for whatever time it took to do to entertain their dealers at a national level, and they would tell you, don't come back until you spend all the money. This was in the 50s and early 60s, before there was any real accounting for expense money. And I will guarantee you, you get a lot of bad habits traveling around the country with pockets full of other people's money. You become convinced that you are part of that, and it's yours. And you live accordingly, and you create a lifestyle for yourself that is very, very hard to change once you can't maintain it anymore. My first wife, I got tired of me being down all the time, and eventually we split up. We tried briefly to patch it up, and I continued to drink worse than I ever drank before. And one day after our marriage had split up for good, I started going with the girl that I'm married to today, and she accompanied me to the airport that day to pick up a couple of dealers from out of town and bring them to the plant, and we all four came back late, drunk, and I was fired on the spot. It's hard to get fired from a company of all alcoholics, but if you persevere, you can get the job done, and I persevered. When I was fired from the company, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know that everyone in my profession knew that Dick Edwards was a liar and a thief and a full-blown alcoholic, and if you touched him with a 10-foot pole, just when you needed him the most, he would let you down. And when I found that out, and I found everyone knew it but me, I was shocked. I had heard one time when I was in Arizona, a business associate of mine over there said something to me once in a bar. He said he would take Dick Edwards drunk against any 10 salesmen he ever knew sober. I knew that wasn't true, but I liked the ring of it, and it occurred to me when I was in trouble. And I told my wife to be, don't worry, baby, you stick with me, you'll be wearing diamonds as big as red apples. Something good is going to happen in my life, and if you hang onto my coattails real tightly, you're going to be a part of it. And for some reason, this poor soul believed me. And I called this guy in Arizona and asked him for the job. He was shocked. It was bar talk. He didn't mean it. And I knew he didn't mean it when he came on the telephone. But I had nowhere else to go, and I more or less forced him into hiring me. I took my wife and her two children by her previous marriage to Parker, Arizona. If any of you know anything about Parker, Arizona, you will know that they don't have jobs for self-styled big-shot sales managers of large corporations. In fact, the job I went over to take, I was fired from in a few weeks for drinking too much. Jobs are hard to come by in small towns like that, a town of 2,500 people, and it's a very seasonal area. I started tending bar. I found that I was a natural at tending bar. I had sat on that side of the bar so long my ass was round. When I got on this side, I could intuitively make any drink that was called for. It just was like that. The job only paid $1.50 an hour, but I was glad to get it because the owner of that bar was a prince. He said, Dick, you can drink anything you want behind the bar as long as someone buys it for you and as long as you don't get drunk behind the bar. In those days, in my mid-30s, I could drink all day and all night and apparently not be drunk. I was drunk, but I didn't look drunk. And so I would have paid him $1.50 an hour to work there had I had it. The job didn't work every night, and if I was drunk, I had to wash dishes in that same place, and I washed dishes in that roadside cafe in Park, Arizona. I drove a beer truck a few days a week. I dug septic tanks in the ground. I hung aluminum awnings on house trailers. I painted signs. I cleaned motel rooms. I worked a boat dock pumping gas, and all those jobs paid $1.50 an hour. I was working night and day, and I didn't know that I was the problem, and I didn't know that booze was killing me. My wife was the kind of woman who never said anything about my drinking. She never reprimanded me about my drinking. Never said, Dick, slow down. Why do you drink so much? Will you come home early tonight? Never said any of those things. After a couple of years in Parker, Arizona, and the desperation that accompanied that, I didn't know what was wrong, and I just resigned myself that this is where I was going to live the rest of my life. I had had it good, and now I don't have it good anymore, and that's the way it is. A man that I had known in sales many years prior had been in Phoenix on a convention, and he got lost on the side road and came through Parker instead of going to Blythe. And he stopped in the bar I was working in to ask directions. And he saw me tending bar there, and he said, Dick, what in the hell are you doing here? And I said, I don't know. And he said, if you can get back to L.A., I'll get you a job in sales and help you get back on your feet. I went home that night, and I told my wife, baby, it's starting to happen. We've got a big job over on the coast now, no problem. Stick with me, you'll be wearing diamonds as big as red apples. I wish you could have seen us leaving Park, Arizona the next day. We left the next morning. I was reflecting a week or two ago, if I had to move today, it would take me a month to get out of town. I couldn't move the stuff we've accumulated since we've lived in this little house. It would take me months to get out of there. When we lived in Park, Arizona, we were gone the next morning. We had everything we owned after 37 years of gracious living in around that car. We had a 55 Mercury. The windows were busted out because my wife would not give me the keys one night, and I wanted to drive. I knocked the windows out with my fists. And I never would get them fixed because I wanted those broken windows to be a constant reminder that he'll never deny me what I want when I want it. We had our two kids in the back. We had a bigger dog with his tongue hanging down to his belly button. It was August of 1967. It was about 125 degrees. We had a canvas bag tied onto the bumper. We had mattresses on top of the car. It looked like the grapes of wrath and tobacco road all wrapped up into one package. And we came steaming back into San Diego and rented the little house that we still live in today. We eventually bought that house. The reason I rented that house is because her folks lived next door and managed an apartment building. They were drinkers, not real class drinkers, but they were drinkers, and I knew if I moved close to them, I'd always have something to drink. And that's the way alkies make decisions, you know. The reason I rented it, there's a full rent sign in the line, and her folks lived next door, and they had booze. That's why I lived there. And it's the same way with jobs. Alcoholics don't have many decisions to make when it comes for taking jobs. You take the first job that's offered. And then you look for other jobs after you have a job. It's always the first thing that comes along. And it's amazing that it is that way, but it is that way. I went down the next morning to apply for the job. I borrowed a suit of clothes from a guy who preceded me on the program by 2 years. I borrowed a car from him. And I went to 6th and Olive in downtown LA and applied for the job. I came back and my wife was sitting on the porch. And she said, did we get the job? And I said, yeah, we got the job, but we won't be there very long. She said, why not? And I said, it's a 50-year-old company and they're professional people and I know they won't go along with my drinking and running around like I do, so don't start spending the money yet. Two more thought of my own, that job was to last for 8 years. The first 3 years I worked there, I did everything I could to get fired. I threatened to kill the owner of the company one night when we were on convention in Sacramento. He suggested I come up to the room and get dressed for the banquet. I thought he said, get away from the bar and come to the room. He didn't say that, but that's what I heard him say. And I went to the room and in front of the rest of the sales department, I said, if you ever say anything about my drinking, you're going to kill you. And I meant it more than anything I'd ever said in my life. And it didn't even scare me. And I didn't care if I got fired. He'd infringed on my right to drink. And I didn't get fired. And the job went on. I never worked. It was an extremely low-paying job at a very high commission. And I never made my quota. I never earned commission. But it's the only thing I had going for me. Instead of going to work a lot of days, I would play policeman. It's the only thing I had going that would give me any feeling of self-worth. My beat was on Rosemead, between Rosemead and the 605 on the San Bernardino Freeway. And if I was feeling particularly low, I would drive down on the freeway. And if I saw someone driving in a little erratic way, I would drive up alongside of them in my old car and I would go like this. And the first guy that went over and stopped on the side of the road, I was amazed. But I followed him over, and I got out of my car, and I followed police procedure. I went around to the passenger side, and I looked through the window to make sure his hands weren't moving around. And if he had his hands on the steering wheel, I'd come around on the driver's side, and I'd tell him to put his wallet with his license facing up on the dashboard, and then to remove it from the holder, and then hand it to me and keep his other hand on the steering wheel. I weighed 220 pounds. My complexion was maroon. I was dressed much like I'm dressed now, and I got away with it every time. And every time I got away with it, it made me feel better. So I go to work and you can be a policeman on the San Bernardino Freeway. One day I'm on the 605 freeway. I'm heading for Whittier Boulevard on the 605 because I had 25 cents in my pocket. And beer at Willie's Ready Room was 25 cents. There were some big kids in a Dodge Charger going south on the 605 freeway, and they're shooting a bean gun out of me out the side of their window, and a tick, tick, tick on the side of my old car. It infuriated me. And I went like this, and I went like this. Unbeknownst to me, they were shooting at another guy on the other side of him, and we got him in sort of a flying wedge and got him off the freeway. And I went up to the car and threw the doors open and started pulling kids out, and I felt a tap on my shoulder. And a voice said, "Are you a police officer?" And something told me, "No, Dick, not today." And I said, "No, I'm not, but I wish I were, because these kids could have caused an accident. I'm drunker than a hoot owl, and I'm saying these kids could have caused an accident." And the voice behind me said, "I happen to be an off-duty police officer. I'll take care of this. You can go now." And I got back in my old car, and I headed south for Willie's Ready Room. And about halfway there, my alcoholic brain started taking over, and I started worrying, was that another Alfie pulling my number? And I almost went back to check him out for headspace, but discretion is the better part of valor, so I didn't do it, thank God. And that's the kind of things that were happening to me. June 4th, 1971, my wife told, quite a ways before that, she told me she was having her 20th high school reunion. We both went to school here in Los Angeles. And my wife is the kind of a woman that knows everybody she ever went to school with. All the kids she went to kindergarten with, all the kids to grammar school, all the kids to junior high, all the kids to high school, and they're all still speaking to her. And I couldn't believe it. You know, I went to school to eat my lunch. I don't know one soul that I went to school with. And that's the God's truth. And when my wife told me she had this big deal going, I vowed to myself, I am going to be good that particular day, June 4th, 1971. So that day came, and my way of being good was to leave the house at 6 o'clock in the morning. Instead of going down on San Bernardino Freeway, I went on San Diego Boulevard at the Tip Top, where I started my drinking most days. They had a sign above the cash register that says, "It's my life, I live it, I love it, criticism be damned." If you're an alcoholic, that'll get you a good start on your day. Then I would cruise down on Garvey Avenue in El Monte. And I would go to the Wee Nippy and the Balboa and the Lucky Spot and the Dollhouse. I assure you, if you're drinking in the Dollhouse near Peck and Garvey in beautiful downtown El Monte, at 6 o'clock in the morning, the guy sitting next to you is not another social drinker. I'll guarantee you that. I would drink there for the morning, then I'd drift up to the Save Hand in Arcadia, and about 5 o'clock that afternoon, I went home. I was just as sober as I am right this minute. I went home and my wife was beaming. "Thanks, Dick, for coming home so early. You've got time to get dressed and we'll get out to Encino to the Sportsman's Lodge where this function is." And she was just ecstatic that my condition, I was sober, everything was wonderful. I went in and got a shower and got dressed. I had 2 water glasses of Red Mountain Pink Chablis. That was my drink of choice in those days. It was $1.56 a gallon, and in my estimation, it's the best all-time buy I ever found in my life. And fortified with my pink Chablis, we headed for Encino. I was just as sober as I am right this minute. We got to the party, and she said, "I'm on the committee. I've got some things to do. Go to the bar and entertain yourself." And I said, "Lady, you're talking my language." I went to the bar. I ordered a double Tanqueray martini on the rocks and drank it. It tasted wonderful. I ordered another and drank it. It tasted wonderful. About that time, her friends came in. I was sober as I am right this minute. We sat down at tables of 10. She introduced me to her 10 closest or 8 closest friends. We had drinks before dinner, we had drinks during dinner, we had wine with dinner, we had drinks after dinner. At the end of the evening, my wife was beaming. She came to me and she said, "Dick, God, I'm having so much fun. One of the kids wants us to come to their house on Mulholland. We're supposed to buy a quart of booze and go up there and have an after-hours party." I hadn't pinched anybody's wife. I hadn't fallen on the dance floor. I was a perfect gentleman. We stopped and bought a bottle of booze. I was just as sober as I am right this minute. We went to their house. We drank booze on the floor all night. 5 quarts of booze amongst us. We drank it all out of bottles. I drove home on the 210 freeway at 5:30 the next morning. I was just as sober as I am right this minute. My wife rewarded me handsomely when I got home. The next morning at 6, I arose. I went on my rounds of the morning, and I didn't come home for 10 days, and I didn't go to work for 10 days. I had enough booze on June 4th, 1971 to get me on a real good drunk. When I came home, June 14th, 1971 was the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, only I didn't know it. The Tuesday afternoon that I came, I found myself in a little place in Temple City called 9416. I didn't know how I knew it was there. I didn't know how I knew what it was. I had never been a blackout drinker, and on this Tuesday afternoon, I'm standing in the middle of the room talking to a guy that I've never seen before. I'm dressed much like I am now. I'm bloated from two weeks of drinking. I asked him the only intelligent question I could think of, and that was, is this the place you come if you have a problem with booze? And he looked at me in a strange way, and he started describing a hitchhiking trip he had taken through France the previous summer. He started describing a bowel movement he had beside the road. He started describing the size of it and the color of it and the texture of it. And I thought, there is something wrong here. I am not in the right place. This is not a place for people like myself. And I turned to go. And I asked a guy laying on one of the greasy couches before I hit the door the same question. Is this the place you come if you have a problem with booze? He turned over to talk to me, and I saw he had a Mickey of wine sticking out of his back pocket. And he said, it's been the place for some, but I haven't been able to make it. And I walked out the door. At that time, there was a little man coming through the door. He said, are you looking for an AA meeting? And I said, yes. He said, come back at 8:30 tonight. There will be somebody here to help you. I went home that afternoon, and I told my wife, she hadn't seen me in 10 days. She didn't say, where have you been, you son of a bitch, or why are you doing this to me, or none of the things that I would expect a woman to say. I told her, I found someone that's going to help me with my drinking. And she said, okay. And I went to that meeting that night. There was a little gal leaving the meeting. Her name was Sherry. She was 2 years clean and sober. She asked me to read the portion of Chapter 3 that's read at our meetings, and she said in the introductions that if you ask to do something for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you cannot say no. Dick, would you read this portion of Chapter 3? And she came down and gave it to me, and I read it. And when I finished reading it, I started crying. I saw the agony and the loneliness and the disease of alcoholism as it had manifested itself in my life. And I started crying, sobbing uncontrollably. Believe me, my favorite thing to do is not cry in front of a bunch of total strangers, because that is definitely not manly. But I was racked by this booze, and I was sick and nervous, and it was a basket case. That little Sherry came up to me at the coffee break, and she said, Dick, it's going to be all right. You're going to make it. I can tell. And I don't know if she could tell or if she could tell how she could tell. The important thing that happened for me was somebody gave me some words of encouragement, and I started going to meetings there every day. They had trick questions at the club. They said crazy things like, did you drink every day? I said, yeah, I drink every day. Good, we go to a meeting every night. I said, well, okay. And the first year, they took me to 352 meetings. The second year, over 300. And about that time, I wished I'd told them I was a periodic. But then I heard them go in a periodic when they came in there, and they asked this guy, did you drink every day? He said, no, I'm a periodic. He said, good, periodics go to a meeting every night. So it wouldn't have done any good, whatever you say, well, gotcha. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life, because people saw through my cheap shit and treated me for what I was, a golden-plated flake that was unproductive, kind of productive when it was productive. They saw through my act. They just wouldn't let me get by with anything. They would strip you naked verbally and leave you standing there, just, you know, what happened to you? Nobody ever talked to me like that in my life, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. My wife started going to Al-Anon. I was not pleased with that. If I can't be the star attraction, I don't want to be part of the deal. And when I came home after being sober for a while, and I saw on her nightstand a book, it looks much like our book, and it says in the cover, The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage. I accused her of all kinds of real and imaginary things. I said, what are you telling those people down there about me? And she said, Dick, I assure you, we're not talking about you down there. We have found a way to go regardless of whether you're going to dinner or not. And I thought, Jesus Christ, they're leaving me out of the whole deal. I wanted to tell them how good I'm doing, you know. And she used to say things like, Dick, you're sicker than I thought. Yeah. I didn't know where she was learning this new language and this new maturity and this new self-assurance. And I told her, I said, you bet you wouldn't even have an Al-Anon unless I was an alcoholic. I'm so desperate that I'm trying to make myself look bigger and her look smaller, and in so doing, I make myself look small and her look bigger than life. And that's the way it was for me. Alcoholics Anonymous has been the best thing that has ever happened in my life. Doors have opened to me since I've been an active and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous that were always close to me in the past. I've had people that I knew before, and people that preceded me here tell me, Dick, if you learn nothing else here, you'll learn who you are. Not what you want to be, or not for what you would like other people to think you are, but for what you really are, and be able to accept yourself for that. And it is true. I can't accept Dick Edwards for what he is. I have no longer any illusions of grandeur. I used to have plenty. When I couldn't deliver, my ego was magnified out of all proportion. Now today, I realize what my capabilities are. I know what my shortcomings are. Through the teachings of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I can exist in a comfortable way. And it's been the best deal I've ever had. If I could have written a script for the things that have happened to me since I've been an active and sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my wildest dreams, I wouldn't have put down the things that have actually happened. I would have set my sights so much lower for myself and been satisfied with so much less. And my wife goes to a lot of Al-Anon retreats, and I have not always been happy about that. When I was newly sober, one lady went over rehab. I had bought our first new car since we were on the program. And I am very possessive about things like that. I don't know if I'll ever get over it. I'm not saying it's right. It's just the way I am. I don't know if there's anyone else like that here. But when I buy new things in my house, they're mine until they get old, and then I give them to you. And she was going to an Al-Anon retreat at Mary Joseph Retreat House in Palos Verdes with a very dear friend of hers. And I learned about that time that Al-Anons converted retreats with men. The crummy retreats I went to out at Manresa were all stag retreats. And I thought, what is this nonsense? These all are men and women. Then I learned that Mary Joseph Retreat House overlooks the Pacific Ocean. It's a rainy night. I learned that they serve wine at Al-Anon retreats, at a retreat house. Why not? They're not alcoholic. But my alcoholic brain started worrying because my wife said she would be home at 8. She wasn't home at 8. So I started thinking, men, women, wine, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Rainy night. You know, it didn't bode well for me. And then I get to thinking, she's had an accident. She started home on the harbor freeway and she's wrecked my car. God, no luck that she did this, you know. The little boy and I that we had, we're doing so well and everything's going so fine. How could she do this? And my sick thinking starts taking over. And then I get to thinking, maybe it'll be all right. Maybe I'll meet a new lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. We can go to conventions together. Her husband probably would have died and left her pretty well fixed. They probably would have had a house in Arrowhead and one in Palm Desert. God, this is going to be all right. About that time, my wife walked in. I was madder than hell. And I said, baby, you'll never believe what I was just thinking. And she said, probably not, but try me. And I told her what I had on my mind, and she said, Dick, you're sicker than I thought. And that's been her constant report. And I am sicker than she thought. And I am sicker than I thought, and I got here just in time. I was 40 years old when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 57 years old now, and I am one grateful guy. I can't say that I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, but boy, am I grateful that there is a place for alcoholics, a place where people understand you and will accept you for what you are. I have a kid that's going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and in my estimation, he's not doing well, but he's going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never thought it would happen. I have other kids. My one son that's working in Germany for 3 years, he's doing fantastic. I've got another son that is going to take over our little family business that we've had for 11 years on August 31st. I was talking to my friend Tom about that and sharing it with him. And I've got a daughter that's not doing well and has never done well. And she's the oldest of all the children. She's my only girl and my favorite, if there is such a thing for a father. And my daughter ran off with a guy that works in a carnival. And every father's dream for his only girl child is not for her to run off with people in carnivals. I have nothing against people that work in carnivals. I just don't happen to know any. And when my daughter told me, she said, Daddy, you don't understand his qualifications. He is foreman of the bumper car rides. I said, I am not impressed. And she brought him down to introduce me, and I was afraid. And I asked my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they ripped me up. They said, you son of a bitch. Where were you when that girl needed you? How many hash marks do you have in the daddy department? I said, gee, I'm sorry, I asked for your advice, you know. And they said, go out to the airport and meet those kids and stick your hand out and say hi. And I went out to the airport at Burbank and saw him come in from Northern California. And I saw my beautiful girl come out on the ramp. And then I looked at all the guys and I picked out the dumbest looking son bitch I could find. And it was him. They came to my house for about 15 minutes and they went to Disneyland and stayed there for 3 days. My daughter said, he has to see how the really big rides go. And I said, I understand. And they came back and he had a little hat like Dopey wears and he had his name on it. And I thought, poor sumbitch can't find his hat without his name on it. So they went back to Northern California. Mercifully, that relationship only lasted for 4 years. And the best thing that happened is they never had children and they never got married. When she had a series of relationships like that. She liked airheads. She took kids to raise and tried to make men out of them. And that's her. It's not them. She had one guy that was, she said, Daddy, you like this guy. He's real nice. He doesn't work in a carnival. In fact, he doesn't work at all. But his daddy owns a construction company. When his daddy dies, he's going to inherit this construction company. I said, how old is his dad? And she said, 46. It's okay. I have gotten out of my own way. I quit taking myself so seriously. I stopped believing my own press notices long ago. When I get sick and troubled about things like this, I go talk to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous and we sit down and we read something out of a big book and it seems like it's for the first time that I'm reading a new passage. And we go to a different meeting that night and we share our experience, strength, and hope to the best of our ability. We try to get along with people on a daily basis and we try to be better than we were the day before. And it doesn't work every day, but if it works one day, it's better than it was before. And it's the best deal I ever had in my life. If I had to sum up in one word what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, that word would be hopelessness. One definition of the word hopelessness in the dictionary is incurable. And I'm just as incurable tonight as I was June 14th, 1971. My disease can only be arrested through total abstinence. And if I had to sum up in one word what keeps me at Alcoholics Anonymous, that word would be hope. And one definition of the word hope in the dictionary is the pursuit of an idea or a thing with a reasonable assurance that it can be obtained. And I'm convinced that we can maintain and obtain this thing called sobriety together. Thank you, Clancy, for having me, and God bless you.